An airstrike was carried out by Israeli forces on Iran's embassy in Syria's capital city, Damascus. It's been reported that three senior commanders and four officers who were part of overseeing covert operations in the Middle East were killed in the strike. This has brought the continually increasing tensions throughout the Middle East and long-standing conflicts to light as Israeli forces maintain their presence in Gaza and more states in the region become involved in the conflict. This brings us to our own questions of how did we get here and where we may be heading next. From Seton Hall University, this is The Global Current. I'm your host, Trisha Ballion. With me today are two fellow Seton Hall students. Covering the domestic situation today is our analyst, Madeline Kuzinski. Hi, Madeline.
Hello.
And focusing on the international aspect today is Nev Walker.
Hey, Nev.
Hey, Trish.
So before we get too far into the conversation, I'm going to turn to you, Madeline, first. If you could just give us some more background information on what's happening and tell us more about the attack itself on the embassy.
Yeah, of course. So as Trish kind of mentioned, Israeli warplanes bombed Iran's embassy in Syria on Monday in a strike that Iran said killed seven of its military advisors. This was important because one of the military advisors was one that kind of directs the flow of goods in and out of Iran and also gives aid to Hezbollah, which is one of the country's militant groups.
I just want to add on that this airstrike happened on April 1st, and it took almost or even a little bit longer than 2 weeks for Iran to actually respond to this attack.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
The history behind Iran and Syria and those ties have not always been hostile. Iran was actually one of the first Muslim countries to recognize the new state of Israel. It wasn't until the supreme leader of Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, came into power where ties were weakened. Under this power, the leader regarded the U.S. as United States as great Satan and Israel as little Satan. And this kind of brought about a sentiment within the country where definitely tensions were building up between the two nations. And then as Iran continued to build up economically, they funded proxy militias, as we'll get into a little bit later, in groups such as Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and Yemen, which begun a shadow war between Iran and Israel, which kind of developed over the years.
Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of seeing that in the way that Iran has responded to the conflict in Israel and Gaza and how they've been involved in that whole dynamic, and we'll kind of get into that later when we talk about the domestic conflict itself. And I want to stick with you, Madeline, and ask more about how the government is structured in Iran and why this matters.
Yeah. Iran's supreme leader remains the same as before, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and he has a pretty strong sentiment of punishing Israel for kind of what's going on in the Gaza Strip. He's a head leader of Iran. And one of the biggest, I think, actors in this whole attack was IRGC, which is the military channels that kind of control that relationship with international bodies. And so this kind of ties into why Israel attacked Syria and not Iran itself, because IRGC channels arms and equipment through Syria to Hezbollah, which is their proxy militant group. So Israel, in an attempt to stop this delivery, was kind of a main target of why the attack happened in Syria.
Yeah, and I just want to add on to what Iran means by, in a way, punishing Israel for this attack. Iran's supreme leader did mention that Israeli embassies are no longer safe, specifically saying the embassies of the Zionist regime are no longer safe. And this was said by the senior advisor to the supreme leader. In Tehran, which is Iran's capital, has actually vowed to avenge the seven who has died in the Israeli drone strike. I think it could be argued that with Iran's retaliation, which we will be getting into later, was, you know, avenging the seven who died. Yet with Israeli's response to Iran's response, it's still up in the air whether or not Iran is going to respond, or the Houthis are going to respond, or any other militant group is going to respond, along with the United States, who actually has vowed to give, I think it's around $20 billion more to Israel to fund this genocide.
Mm-hmm. And I know the aid package was just recently passed through Congress, with aid going to Israel in terms of, you know, I'm not sure exactly what makes up the aid package we can expect us to do with, you know, military aid, weaponry, all that stuff like that. And so I want to stick with you, Nev, talking about responses and turn to the international sphere and discuss how Iran responded to this strike on their embassy.
Yeah, so Iran responded to this strike by launching over 200 drones, ballistic missiles, and cruise missiles into Israeli territory. They weren't very successful in this attack. I think over half of the missiles failed to even launch or go into Israel. Around 5 actually hit different Israeli bases. And most of these missiles, most of these drones, were actually struck down from the air by both the Israeli military and the United States military.
And so can we compare that to what we've seen with, like, other instances of violence against embassies around the world?
Yeah, so lately there has, it seems to be, an uptick in embassy violence. And I just want to compare Iran to the Mexican embassy attack recently. So basically, what happened in Mexico's embassy is that it was being raided by Ecuadorian police trying to find prisoners of some sort, which obviously violates the 22nd article of the Vienna Convention. Yet the difference between Mexico's reaction and Iran's reaction is that Mexico does plan to take Ecuador to the International Court of Justice, whereas Iran responded with launching a multitude of different weapons. I think a main difference, too, that we need to note is that Israelis' attack on this embassy did result in deaths, and specifically deaths of really high military personnel. So I think, obviously, the different reactions, it could be argued that they were warranted. I think it's really important to note that Mexico's embassy was raided by an outside party in Mexico, whereas Iran's embassy was also attacked in Syria, a third nation, which I think is also important to take in consideration, specifically about different responses by, you know, Syria or Iran or Israel.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And on that note, what have we seen from Israel regarding their actions?
Yeah, the weird thing is Israel, it hasn't made an official statement regarding this attack, but they did claim that there was attack earlier that day on April 1st. Regarding Iran attacking Israel. Israel also did respond to the attack in a multitude of ways. For example, there was an airstrike that hit right inside Iran, which a U.S. official told CNN, which is a move that threatens to further escalate regional conflict now that third parties such as Iran is getting involved. An Iranian official did also say that they did intercept at least 3 drones from air defenses, yet there has been no mentions or report of a missile attack by Israeli forces sent after Iran's attack in Israel. But it's actually very interesting because it seems that the United States, who is a strong supporter of Israel, was given advanced notice of the Israeli strike that went to Iran after Iran's response. That being said, the United States, they did not endorse the response, said a U.S. official. That being said, they didn't really make this known to the public, nor did they do anything to stop this retaliation.
And did we see any more responses from other countries in the Middle East? I know that, like, Lebanon and Jordan have also been mentioned in regards to this conflict. Have they had said anything regarding this attack?
Yeah, so there was an international response, not only to the attack from Israel, but also the retaliation. So first, I want to mention different Middle Eastern countries. So it's actually very interesting to note that the United Arab Emirates was actually the first country to condemn the airstrike from Israel. There's actually a statement that was released by the UAE Foreign Ministry that, quote, like, condemning the targeting of the Iranian diplomatic mission in the Syrian capital, Damascus. So they have released statements regarding condemning this action. Along with this, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Oman, and Kuwait did denounce this attack as well. It's actually also very interesting to note that the only country in the Gulf Cooperation Council that has yet to release a response supporting either side is Bahrain.
That is very interesting. And I want to turn back to you, Madeline, just to kind of get more into the domestic conflict itself. So backtracking a little bit, could you explain how Iran and Syria have become involved in the conflict in Gaza and how that kind of fits into the timeline we've been seeing of this whole conflict?
Yeah, so Iran is one of the largest powers in the Middle East. And through this power they have, they do allegedly fund and arm Palestinian groups, including Hamas and Hezbollah. And this is something that Iran has denied, but a lot of evidence does support this funding for decades. And so considering the state of the conflict happening in the Gaza Strip with Israel and Hamas, in Israel's perspective, it makes sense to attack Iran, which is funding, again, the arms and weaponry of Hamas. And so another reason why they chose, I mentioned it before, chose Syria and not Iran was, one, Iran is a strong power. I think attacking Iran itself would have had a much larger international response, whereas targeting an embassy in Syria will have an effect on the military operations of Iran, but won't exactly have the same incredible effect. And so they hit the Syrian embassy and in Damascus. And attacking the Syrian embassy was important because it resulted in the death of senior commander in al-Qaeda forces, Zahedi. This force is, again, part of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, IRGC, and their main purpose is foreign intelligence and a paramilitary wing. So his position in the military was to command units in Lebanon and Syria, and most likely a critical figure in Iran's relationship with Hezbollah in Syria's president. So the death of this important commander definitely will have a lasting impact on the military capability of Iran, which relies on a network of people across the Middle East. And so now challenges will be faced in Iran due to this murder.
Mm-hmm. I'd also like to add on about why Syria was chosen for this attack. And I think it's definitely very personal. Syria is a strong supporter of the recognizing the statehood of Palestine. They do not support Israel, and they even have never recognized Israel as a legitimate state since its establishment in 1948. It's also very interesting to see that Syria also doesn't even accept Israeli passports as valid passports to enter into Syrian territory. So I don't think it was a coincidence that two countries that are strong supporters of Hamas and of Palestine reaching statehood were both attacked by Israel.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a very strategic way of choosing this attack. And, you mm-hmm. know, like both of y'all have been mentioning, the intention to do an embassy, not necessarily within the country, mm-hmm. brings in a third party. And so I want to ask you, Madeline, how was this attack carried out and kind of what destruction did we see outside of the embassy?
So yeah, so the impact of the attack outside of the embassy was limited. Two deaths were resulted. One of them, as I mentioned before, is Zahedi, senior commander, and then Haja Rahimi, which is another high up military leader, but information about his exact workings in the military was not exactly stated.
Mm-hmm. And so what was Iran's intention with their initial action against Israel, and how is that retaliation in Syria now connected to that? Kind of just that whole dynamic of back and forth we've seen, kind of like attacks being traded.
Okay, so Iran's attack with Israel was a series of projectiles fired from Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen, all downed in Israel by the U.S., the U.K., and Jordan, some of Israel's allies. There were estimated 300 drones and missiles towards Israel, as stated by the Israeli military. One thing that's important to note, however, through this is Iran did release a statement prior to the launching of these missiles, which allows Israel to better deter. And so this shows an important feature of Iran's intention, which was more to show the capability and kind of as a message to Israel, kind of letting them know that we do have capabilities to attack, but not necessarily to escalate the conflict happening in the region.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So it was more of a statement than, you know, an actual malevolent attack, declaration of escalation of sorts. Mm-hmm. So I want to turn back to you, Nev, and ask about the international law aspect of all this. Could you explain the significance of the UN Charter and how this kind of interconnects with the international law surrounding this conflict and the strike on Iran?
Yeah, actually, before I get into the significance of Article 51 of the UN Charter, I want to go back to the Vienna Convention, specifically Article 22. It is directly stated in this article that the receiving state is under special duty to take all appropriate steps to protect the premises of the mission against any intrusion or damage, and to prevent any disturbance of the peace of the mission or impairment of its dignity. I think this quote is especially important because we need to discuss the nuances of this attack. Yeah. It could be said that the receiving state is Syria, and because of their lack of response or their lack of protection of the state, one could argue that Syria, along with Israel, has breached international law, which is definitely very interesting. Now I want to get into the significance of Article 51 of the UN Charter and a little bit of the historical evidence from the past 6 months. So after the October 7th attacks by the Palestinian terrorist organization Hamas, Israel did claim self-defense for their continued bombardment of Gaza, using Article 51 of the United Nations Charter to justify their attack. According to Article 51, there's nothing in the present charter that shall impair the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the United Nations. Yet this article then goes on to say that the self-defense is excused until the UN Security Council takes the measures needed to, quote, maintain international peace and security. What I find specifically interesting about this specific article is that it can be both applied to Israel's response after October 7th, but it could also just as easily be used to justify Iran's attack on Israel after the embassy was bombed. And because of the clause about the UN Security Council maintaining international peace and security, because of this clause, it designates that a country does have a right to self-defense until the UNSC meets and takes the measures needed. But then this raises the question, what is the measures needed, and how can the United Nations Security Council, which has been said to be pretty ineffective because of veto power, how can they take the measures to maintain international peace and security? And then this again raises the questions about the legality for Israel's continuation and escalate of the war in Gaza for the past 6 months, considering there has been a multitude of resolutions that have passed. For example, Resolution 2023/2720, along with Resolution 2023/2718, they are both related to providing peace and stability in the Middle East and in the Gazan area. Yet these resolutions, because of the measures that need to be taken in order to pass these resolutions, they don't seem to be enforced thoroughly. And therefore, there can be a claim that the UNSC has not yet taken the measures needed to maintain international peace and security. So it can be argued that Israel, despite it seems that they are breaching Article 51 and taking advantage of it, it can be argued that they are legally using this article.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that just gets into questions of proportionality and how, you know, self-defense can really be defined in international conflicts like this.
Yeah. And if we compare and contrast Israel's bombardment of the Gazan area compared to Iran's retaliation against Israel, is that it seems like Israel was purposely attacking hospitals, UN schools, and other like refugee camps, with the goal, they have said that their goal is to continuously attack until they terminate Hamas completely and entirely. And because of the status of Hamas being a terrorist organization by Israel, the United States, and other actors, and the fact that they are running Palestine right now, international law does not necessarily inhibit using force like Israel has been doing to eliminate a group like Hamas, considering they are presenting a threat to the sovereignty of Israel. And because of this loophole in international law, And because Palestine does not hold complete member status in the United Nations, Israel can technically, legally justify their actions. Along with this, the United States can argue plausible deniability in its aid in this genocide and in its continuous aid package. But comparing Israel's use to Iran's use of Article 51, it can be argued that Iran, because of their embassy being directly attacked, they do have a right to self-defense, considering they did wait around 2 weeks after their attack of the embassy to do anything about it, and the UN Security Council did not take the measures needed to maintain peace. And it also seems that Iran was more of launching a warning strike other than launching full-out war. So it is important to acknowledge the differences in goals. For Israel, it is to terminate Hamas completely, whereas Iran was just trying to attack mainly military buildings and military bases.
Mm-hmm. And so we're going to be needing to look towards the future to see how this will continue to develop, mm-hmm. and how different legal actions might be taken in the future as, you know, the conflict progresses. And on the note of the future, I want to wrap things up by turning to you, Madeline, and asking how these developments have impacted the pre-existing relations in the region.
Yeah, so it goes without saying, tensions are very high in the region. I think that with this escalation, I think that that draws in pretty much every body in the region into this escalation. However, noting the restraint that Iran did show, kind of giving Israel the heads up about the strike, it is assumed that escalation, direct escalation between the two nations is not likely. This is also backed by a Hebrew University poll in Israel that says 3/4 of respondents value Israel's international and regional alliances above any benefit of striking Iran. So we kind of see internally in Israel, they're not looking for escalation as they already have, you know, another fight they're kind of dealing with right now. And further polls also show that Israel is wary of direct attacks on Iran, noting their alliances and noting that the power that Iran has in the region. However, this does not by any means mean that escalation, indirect escalation, is not possible and will not continue to happen. I've mentioned a few times before, Iran does fund various different militant groups in the region, namely the Houthis, which during this whole conflict, the Houthis have controlled the Red Sea, which has limited the ability of trade on the Red Sea, which has had economic impacts across the world. And so through this rise in tensions, it is plausible that Iran will continue to fund and fund maybe even stronger these militant groups that will affect Israel, but not in a direct way.
Mm-hmm. And so what changes could occur due to these rising tensions and these like indirect ways of responding to this conflict? What impact could that have on Israel's attack on Gaza?
So with that escalation, the international community has been becoming a louder voice in this, with countries that were kind of on the fence now making repeated statements urging Israel to exercise restraint, not responding to Iran, and warning of a spiraling conflict that will affect the global community, but also Israel. So we kind of see with this rise in tensions across the globe, a stronger international voice that's really kind of, I think, criticizing Israel now, because we're seeing this come to the kind of continue to play out, but also urges both sides, Iran and Israel, to kind of exercise restraint in this conflict as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And so turning a little more domestically to Israel, mm-hmm. are Israeli officials giving any indication of backing off from Gaza because of the military actions are now being taken by states like Iran? Is this having an impact on them and their, I guess, intentions in Gaza?
So the short answer, no. Israel has made it very clear that they would have a significant response to the attack. No response has been made yet, I think partially because of this international community, including the U.S., urging Israel Prime Minister Netanyahu not to attack, considering our aid that the U.S. provides to Israel.
So this has been a really great discussion. Unfortunately, we are running out of time. So I just want to say thank you to both you, Nev, Madeline, for coming on and joining us today.
Okay, thank you so much for having me.
Yep, thank you so much.
So this is all the time we have for today. Be sure to follow The Global Current on Instagram and LinkedIn for updates on upcoming shows. This show would not have been possible without our dedicated crew, executive producer Bobby Kyle, associate producers Kasia Kostrava and Juliana Mori, technical producers Ashley Skladani and Amelia Vincechinsky, and of course your host, Trisha Ballion. The Global Current is brought to you by Seton Hall University. As always, keep it current with us and catch us on the waves every Sunday at 8:30 a.m. on 89.5 FM WSOU. Until next time, thanks y'all.